Hey, everybody, welcome to Big Blend Radio. Super excited to welcome back Dave Kirzner to the show. I think it was right before the pandemic that he was on the show. God, what was it?
Yeah.
With the album Breakdown, a compilation, 1995 to 2019. Right. Yeah, Dave. I mean, did we start the pandemic? No, I'm kidding. It was right before. That was crazy. It was right before your
Yeah.
album came out. And I remember you having all these plans and then like things went sour, but the album was good.
For
Thank
everybody,
goodness. Yeah.
like there was just a standstill on touring and all sorts of things, but a good time to write music and work at home in isolation. So I kind of do that anyway. So it wasn't even that different for me, but
Yeah. Well, being on the road full time, it was a little different, but
I
we had,
bet.
but we did a lot of parks because no one was there. It was really cool. So
Oh, that's
I think
cool.
it's, so we had a little different experience, but thank goodness for new music. It keeps us traveling. But, and I bring up travel because your new album, well, that's a little bit of travel in there. And it was from a heart, like a heartbreak, really, right? So we want to tell everybody a little about this because this started when you were younger. So the new album, everybody, Heartland Mines, Volume One. So this is a big breakup. Right.
Yeah, well, it was at the time. I was in my 20s in the mid 90s, and I met this girl. She was a singer, and I'm a keyboard player. So, the thing in LA is it's tricky. There's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it's great that there's so many entertainment people, music people, if you're a musician. So you have things in common, but then there's potentially just the trap of maybe being used or something like that, for like, oh, will you produce my demo? And then goodbye. And I've seen it happen. And of course, it's easy to be objective when you see it happen to someone else. But when you fall for somebody, you don't want to think that it's like that, but it's pretty much what it was. She was very, aggressively talking about, well, only if you're serious about marriage, like, because this is it, this is you're the one. And I'm like, I'm 25, I don't know anything. I'm like, I didn't want to ruin it, so I'm like, yeah, I'm open, so she became my fiance really quicker than I would have or should have. And then when the record company was interested, she was dropping me like, backpedaling the whole thing. And I had moved into her apartment. So I had all my equipment in storage. It was a great apartment near the beach in Santa Monica, but I was kind of homeless, technically. I mean, we broke up, whatever. And I left when that happened. And I decided instead of staying with friends and finding a new place, I thought, let me just grab a suitcase and a guitar and just drive. Without a plan, just think
Sweet.
about this and all that. So that I wrote songs on the journey, and I never finished them. So I just put it on the back burner. I tried some different things. I wasn't a front man back then, so I tried different singers over the years, and finally, I just felt like, all right, it's time to revisit those songs from the 90s, finish them. Produce the album. There's a series of albums, the Volume One, and then there's a Volume Two, and maybe more. That's what it is.
Oh man, Little Miss Broadway.
Ah, well, that song. So I used to play with an artist named Kevin Gilbert. And for those who know, he was brilliant. He's no longer with us, sadly. For those who don't know, I strongly urge you to check out kevingilbert.com, check out his music. He was in a band called Toy Matinee. But his biggest success was probably co-writing the songs for Sheryl Crow's first record. And
Okay.
the irony is, the Genevieve, the character in my story, was a lot like Sheryl Crow. And Kevin had a bad, was her boyfriend, and then was also kind of like left in the dust. And so was warning me, saying, dude, you don't want to, and I'm like, of course, I went for it anyway. And we had worked on a song called Leaving Miss Broadway, which was a little bit of
Like
a
leaving Las Vegas. I'm like, oh.
dig, yeah. But it never even made it onto an album as a studio version, but we played it live and it's on a live album. So the diehard Kevin Gilbert fans know that Thud was the name of our band. And so I do make a little reference to another Miss Broadway And that's just, again, these are Easter eggs for people who know that kind of stuff. But even if you don't, it's basically saying like somebody who's putting on a show. And, that's what that is.
Yeah. I think we all know those, and they're drama queens too. And I mean that for guys too. Sorry, but there's people that just, there's always something. There's always this, they'd never, you like them, you know them, but you know something's off. You know what I mean? And you should know those little flags, but you don't have red flags on your cover, your album cover. You've got like boxes flying. And I'm like, dude, no way. But I love that you went from LA, you started driving out, right? And I love the videos, and I hope more are coming, because you always do amazing video work for your music. We want more. But driving, you know, getting in the car and going, yeah, I have to say I've kind of done that kind of thing, especially in the 20s, because everything, you're in that middle, 25, 20, around that age group, you're in that like serious, I'm going to do this. You're not quite in your 30s where you've got your stuff together. But in the 20s, you're in that tweener zone, and you can get played pretty quick at that time, I think.
Yeah, for me, it's since the album's very autobiographical, it's probably the most personal album that I've done, because usually the albums have some sort of sci-fi, they're still personal, but they're sci-fi themed, and I can kind of hide behind the fiction, whereas this is a little more honest, raw, and vulnerable.
In a play, actually, like a music play, listening to it. Like,
oh,
almost
cool.
Being like I was like thinking, oh, you're going to do volume two, then it could be like a stage play, like what Bruce Springsteen did, you know?
First of all, all of those classic rock and progressive rock, but especially classic rock, road trip music were the influences. So everything from Bruce Springsteen to Steely Dan to the Eagles to CSNY to the Beatles, Pink Floyd, of course, but Tom Petty, and it's really Pat Metheny. It's diverse in that sense, because it's that mentality of you're gonna hit the road and listen to some music and think, you know, the lyrics take center stage, as opposed to some of the things I've done before where instrumentation, like solos, and I mean there are solos and everything, but not as many keyboard solos, for instance, which is something I'm sort of known for.
Yeah, this is a little bit more guitar centric on this album, I think.
I mean, I wrote it on guitar. When you're driving cross country, you can't really bring a keyboard, so I brought a guitar, and I like that because I'm mainly a keyboard player, and I write on guitar in a way that's different than guitar players do, because I'm not a traditional like taught guitarist. I taught myself, so I do my own chords, and the guitarist look at me like, what's that? I'm like, well, I go over to the keyboard, that's a major seventh with a, you know, and but I don't even know. I like not knowing while I'm doing it. I can go to the keyboard and figure out what it is, but I'll just take a stab at different things and go, oh, I like that, and or change the tuning of the guitar. And it serves as a nice backdrop for me to write melodies and lyrics, because I don't know what I'm doing. It's all rhythm and feel and feeling, as opposed to the keyboard, where I try to get into that zone, and I do, but I do know what my way about a keyboard. That's what I was taught. So it's nice to just not even think about what chord I'm playing or anything, and just listen to it, the sound of it, and go, oh, that sounds nice, and get inspired. Where I think like really great guitar players have the potential to be like bored with a chord, like, oh, that's not a big deal, that's just a major seventh. And I'd be like, no, this is a six string voicing of a major seventh. I mean, without even knowing it, to me, I'm excited. I'll play it back and forth 20 times, all excited. Whereas someone else who knew more about it would be like, make it more complicated, maybe. So, yeah,
that's interesting. But what about the lyrics? What about the lyrics for you? Does that, when you were writing this, was this mostly lyrical or was the music first? You know, because you're still obviously going, you can feel the emotions and stuff, but like what would you say happens regarding that? Because I suck on guitar, but I write that way, and I have like an orchestra going on my head, and I don't know how to get the orchestra to, because of the limitations of the guitar. So that's kind of interesting how you're flipping it, going, well, no, I got this. You know, in the meantime, I'm going, damn it, I'm going to throw this out the window, but I would never. But, you
it
know, so it's
depends.
interesting.
For me, usually I write the music first and then I start, forming the lyrics out of melodies and everything. In this particular case, it was a little different because let's say if I'm just writing music without necessarily a concept in mind, then it'll just be music and then I'll connect concepts later if it becomes part of a concept album. And I have the freedom to do that because I haven't written the lyrics yet. And I can choose pieces of music. I have all sorts of, hundreds of pieces of music that are songs waiting to happen, let's say musically, but without the lyrics yet. And sometimes I'll even just sing a melody and make up words or, phonetic noises and things that just kind of are placeholders. And ironically, a lot of times those subconsciously, your stream of conscious just become like, oh, that's actually, that would be, that sounds like this, and it would make a good lyric. And then you work from there. In this case, I was writing about the situation I was in and all the emotions I was going through at the time. I don't think I was as confident experienced enough as a lyricist back then to be able to write it at the level that I wanted to. First of all, Kevin Gilbert, who I worked with, is one of the best lyricists of all time. It was an incredible lyricist. So he set the standard really high for me, as did Sting and Roger Waters and other lyricists in classic rock. But to be in his band and see that it can be done, like where it's real clever and poetic and progressive in its own way, actually funny, like diverse in storytelling, and rich with storytelling. I felt like I pushed myself. Ironically, the first song, so I've been writing like music that was pretty good since I was 13, 14, playing with bands. I listened back and like, those are actually good tracks. Some of those tracks, I found one of those tracks from 1987. It became Back to One on this album. It was actually this old track that we used to do with my buddies from high school. So I pushed myself to do the lyrics. The one song that I wrote that I was actually happy with finishing back then lyrically was a song called Not Coming Down, which ended up being released with Sound Contact. And ironically, I wrote that about Kevin's death.
Oh.
Strangely enough. Yeah, about like hearing about, the way he died and all these things. And it was like walking the wall. Like, I can't believe this is real, when I got the phone call, and about thrill seeking and going so high, you're not coming down. It just gave me everything to write. Like I knew exactly how I felt about that situation, about how smart he was and how stupid it was the way he died. Similar to, let's say, someone like Philip Seymour Hoffman, who was brilliant and then died with the needle. And like just one little mistake and that's it, you're gone. And that's kind of what that song is about. So that was the first one. The rest of the songs from that era stayed unfinished, went through drafts over the years. And then finally, after I did The Traveler, my third solo album and various other albums that I've written and produced or co-written, co-produced, I felt like, all right, let's roll up the sleeves and let's do this album. Let's do it right and get everything kind of up to the standard. But this is after being really comfortable and enjoying writing lyrics, because I guess when I was younger, lyrics seemed to be a chore. It was kind of like, like the music came so fast and you're like, lyrically, you're like, what rhymes with blah, 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 and try to like get other people to do it or whatever. And then finally, I just felt like, no, I have to do it. And it has to be based on having something to say. And of course, the other thing is, in retrospect, writing about what I went through in my 20s, now with the wisdom that I have now and the vocabulary and whatever else comes with, I can articulate what I really wanted to say about what was happening and tell the story in a poetic way. Little things like, for instance, in the song Genevieve, which is about the character, the girl who broke my heart. I'm fine about it now, by the way. I don't, but it's, you know, you got to get back into that headspace. And the song Pushed Me Out, which is sort of like a little bit of a reprise. Talk about something unique. I found unique about her as a character. When you talk about the warning signs and seeing things, people, your friends seeing things and saying something, a lot of times it can be something, someone's a trait that's sort of obvious, maybe. Like, for instance, I mean, not to judge, but like if someone's a gold digger, there are signs. If it's someone like that who's like looking for a sugar daddy or whatever it is, like somebody like, oh, you know, she's going to take him, or he, it can be both ways. Right. So, let's say a player, someone like that seems to be male or female, kind of slick, kind of, you know, got game, you know,
saying everything you want, it says everything you want them to say and likes everything that you do.
Yeah.
You already know, like they should. When someone likes every song that you like, or like every, you know what I mean? They're, it's like creepy.
It's not even just that. It's just like, they're just like, they're good. You know, like to just that they're players, and you can see a player, male or female, like when they just have game, right? But she was different. She was a player big time, but she was kind of like a fun loving yoga hippie. And I never would think that someone like that would be playing multiple men and doing a whole thing. I thought it was all like, you know, hey, namaste, peace and love. You know, I just didn't see it coming. That's why A Wolf in Sheep's Clothing is kind of like, she seemed really innocent and very kind of spiritual and all these things. And I thought, how could somebody so spiritual be so kind of devious and, you know, destructive and self-destructive and everything? So, but one of the things that I wanted to work in just as a kind of little piece of the insanity was the word namaste. Because I remember like, you know, I would, there'd be signs of like, let's say there's a guy and there's something going on and I'm thinking, am I paranoid? Am I just, I don't want to be a jealous guy, but there's something going on. Like she hugged that guy for like 2 minutes. What is it?
What am I missing here?
Yeah. Right. And then I'm like, you know, if I said something, you know, like, so what was the deal with that?
You're like a crazy jealous person.
Yeah. And then you go, namaste, namaste, like kind of like peace, you know, and it's like a get out of jail free card. And I just thought in retrospect, it's hilarious. But at the time it was frustrating because I was just kind of like, I don't want to be a disturber of the peace. But I'll tell you one thing that's really interesting. My current relationship that I've been in a relationship for over 2 years is the most peaceful, harmonious relationship I've ever had in my whole life.
Oh, cool.
And the thing is, I've gone through a lot of relationships where there were things like that. I was tested and messed with and whatnot. And, you know, not always, but a lot of times, a little bit of crazy. And I would wonder to some extent, like, is it me? Am I paranoid? Am I a troublemaker? But I don't think I am. And now I know I'm not. Because I'm an easygoing person, and it's just like, as long as I'm with somebody who's compatible with me and an easygoing, relatively, it's fine. And I'm like, okay, I knew it, but
you don't
know it until you experience it, you know? So, but anyway, trouble.
I think it's all about finding the right person. And then you get some people that are two troublemakers at the same time. And then you got Bonnie and Clyde, man. And it's like crazy, like the serious crazy can happen. And then we like to watch that because like we're all weird that way. It's like, dude, go out there and do that so we can watch, but don't do it at home. You know what I mean?
Well, that's what I did. I mean, I essentially went through the heartache and all that crazy stuff, driving cross country, very dramatic, but it's true. And, so that I could have a story to tell, and other people who, let's say, maybe married their high school sweetheart or, you know, play a little safer or wiser can at least enjoy the crazy ride that someone like me went through emotionally.
It's interesting because going on the road too. And so going on the road, right. That is like, okay, it's like clear the cobwebs, right? get on the road, and then there's that moment of like, holy crap, what did I just do? Like, there's like these ups and downs of the road, especially solo travel. And then you want like some crazy road trip thing to happen, like a movie, right? You know, so all these things happen. And I think one of the songs, there's so many songs. I want people to listen to it all the way through because it is autobiographical. Like I said, it would be kind of cool to have it as a stage play kind of thing. But listening, Manic Calm to me is that moment where like the two oceans meet. And I don't know if you've seen Two Oceans Meet, but it's pretty darn incredible. Absolutely. It's magic, calm, and then bam. And I think that happens on the road, no matter what's driving you to go on the road. There are those moments of hurry up and wait. It's like the polar opposites. And it's like, that's a badass song. That's one of my favorites on there.
Oh, really? For some reason. Oh, that's great.
I don't know if it's just I've listened to it quite a few times. So I don't know what it is, but there's something in there. The guitar parts are cool too. You've got some great musicians. Matt on there. He was on our show. Matt's cool. So a lot of people getting on board. So did they all like want to know all the juicy details of your breakup? Or are they just like, let's get into the music?
Some of the musicians recorded back. I used recordings that we did in the 90s on this album. So this album, ironically, travels in time. In that sense, guys like Lyle Workman, who played with Sting and Beck and Jellyfish, Mark McCright, Gene Siegel. So those are the guys I you know, hung around with back then in the 90s in L.A. And then Fernando Perdomo and Matt Dorsey. You know, also we got Elliot Randall from Steely Dan to guest on Back to One. And and then me. I play a lot of guitar on the record this time. Cool. But we, you know, so yeah, I mean, in terms of little milestones along the way on the journey, just before Manic Calm is a song called Worlds Apart. Mm-hmm. And it starts off with a phone call and a disconnection. Mm-hmm. And it's a true story. I kind of got to the point where it was like, did I exactly what you said? Like, did I maybe overreact, or maybe we could talk about this? May I don't have to just, you know, like leave. Cause you know, I left our place, which was her place. And I mean, I guess I could have got a hotel or something, but I just got in the car and went. And then I was like, normally if there's a breakup, let's say maybe you might talk just to see if you can like explain, you know, work it up. Although I had mixed feelings about that because they were very specific, but it's not like I caught her cheating. I just was pretty sure she was cheating. She was kind of backpedaling the whole thing, flirting with the A&R guy, and everything was like bruising my pride. And I just thought, this is not you. You wanted me to marry you, and now you're doing this. I'm like, I'm out of here. I'm not going to stand for this, you know, which is better than, you know, allowing someone to kind of steamroll you. But then I thought, well, let me at least call. And she disconnected the phone. Which is weird because that's like disconnecting from everybody. But that was, to me, it was just like, this person is done and doesn't want to go back and whatever. So I thought, to me, you know, poetically, the tones that you hear, the three tones, do, 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 I sampled it and turned it into an instrument and play it throughout the song. Most people wouldn't know that unless I say it, but that's what you're hearing. For me, it was like saying, like, that's all I have left of these words. We're sorry. Try again. The full thing was like, we're sorry. You reached a number that's been disconnected.
Yeah.
Please try again. But I just took, we're sorry. Try again. The tones. And it's like, that's all that's left, dude. So you got to keep going. And then Manic Calm would be that kind of like duality schizophrenic feeling of like, all right, this was the right thing. This is meant to be. I'm calm. This is cool. No, I'm not.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Like, I can't believe
it. Like, what did I do? And then you're in the middle of the desert somewhere, right? And you had to drive through desert, right? I had to put Joshua Tree there because it just has to be there. But, you know, it's historically good. I mean, Graham Parsons is still lying there somewhere, I suppose, but you never know.
Well, I love the United States. I mean, I've driven cross country many times, actually. You know, the ironic thing, let's say Manic Calm, I mentioned the tumbleweed. And that's kind of referring to Texas.
I was going to say Texas. Exactly.
It's a little long of a drive and a little deja vu with the tumbleweeds.
Well, I'm going to let you know, because as when this airs, we would have just driven across the country, and I'll let you know how it goes. This will be totally, I mean, I've listened inside with headsets and just sat and listened and went through, like I was saying, your other two albums, because it, to me, it was just this whole journey to hear all these sounds. And then thinking about, you know, when you go back to the 90s, you know, how songwriting has changed, how musicians are recording, like, hey, I've heard this, I'm going to just, you know, record it on my phone so I know what I was writing. So that kind of wasn't there at that time. And even when I heard the phone part of "you're disconnected" or "this is gone," you know, I thought that was funny, because we rarely hear that anymore. And now if you disconnect your number, like, that is the end of the world. Like, if your phone is gone and you didn't back up your phone to the cloud, which I've done, on the loneliest road of America, like, everything died. Nancy's phone died. Mine died. No, I did not back it up. No, I am on the loneliest road of America, and I don't know where the hell I'm going, in the middle of the desert, in a pandemic, but somehow there was a Verizon store. So, you know, you get through these things. But how did you record these songs initially? Were you writing them down? How did you... I mean, did you have a tape recorder at that time? Because we did have cassettes back in the day, and they're coming back out again. I wonder how that's going to work.
Well, that's a whole other subject. But as far as what I did, I mean, we recorded it on something called an ADAT, which was a digital recorder that used VHS tapes, actually, and recorded 8 tracks at a time on those. And I borrowed someone's, I still have the tapes. I'm a hoarder, for better or worse, of, like, at least my music. Yeah. You know, I've got all the old cassettes, 4-track cassettes from when I was a kid, everything. I don't know why, but I just do. I just can't throw it out. Cool. So I have all those old ADAT tapes. So I transferred those over, because I thought, it's just kind of, I could have re-recorded everything, but it just captures some of the vibe of what the album, where the foundation, where it came from. So, and they were good, those ADATs. As far as jotting ideas, because I do use the voice message memo thing all the time now. Oh, I know. There was one thing that's dramatically changed for the better. So I've always had just kind of like at least some sort of home studio, if not access to, you know, a pro studio. But but ever since I was a kid, we had a garage band, and, you know, I turned my garage into my own little studio. I mean, even when I was really little, I had like a light bright, remember those? Oh on top of the piano to pretend like I had synthesizers. This has always been the case. But
I love that. That's so cool.
But in the 90s, I had this problem where if I had a song idea, I started just producing it like we were doing the album. I mean, it had its benefits, but you lost track of the idea. You were so deep in already trying to produce it.
Oh, you're already editing. Ooh.
Yeah, you're already sitting there mixing and editing and doing all that stuff. And so years later, I changed to the extreme opposite. I don't care what it sounds like. It's just jotting down the idea as fast as possible. And then keep the idea in here for a little while. And then go in and, you know, and go to the piano first, maybe even there, or the guitar, and work out the arrangement and different things, and then go to the computer and start recording things. Okay. It doesn't have to be, but I find that to be very, it affords me the opportunity to think it through in my head and not get married. That's the problem. You start doing things and you get married.
Don't get married, Dave. Yeah, you know what happens.
The lesson here is don't get married. I'm actually not married. I'm divorced. And I really have no plans to get married. I think, you know, but anyway, that's a separate subject. It's kind of like maintaining objectivity, I guess. And not committing to something yet, because it's not, music's very interesting, because the more you hear it, it becomes maybe an earworm. That's a good thing, because you're like humming it and you're like, hey, I like this. I want to revisit this. Well, when you're the music creator, you listen to it way more than other people probably do. And so it really kind of burns into the brain, and then it becomes kind of hard to hear it any differently. I mean, even if you hear like a mistake, the mistake almost sounds right because you've heard that with the mistake a million times. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was actually one of the hardest things about making this album versus fresh new music is I had so many different lyric drafts, even to the point where when we sang it live, we just played a festival called Prog Stock. Sometimes I was remembering old lyrics and I was like, oh, no, wait, I changed that. Like, oh my God. So it's dangerous to like commit and listen to it a lot and get it burned in the brain when you're still trying to create it. You want to try to leave it here. And then it's like, okay, now I'm committing the final and I'll burn that into my brain, especially if I'm going to perform it live, you know? So that's my new technique. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's like, even with writing and stuff, if you're in it, when you're first creating, you're like in it, you're like, it's like a pancake with a ton of syrup. You're in it. And if you try to edit while you're swimming in the syrup, your wings are heavy. But then once you get out and you look at the pancake with the syrup, I don't know why I'm going there, but it sounds good to me. Actually,
delicious.
Sound always good, you know?
I'm
so
hungry.
Looking at that, but I know. But you can see where to chop. You know what I mean? It's like, oh,
yes.
There's a burnt end here. Oh, this needs a strawberry here. I think we talked about cooking before. That's what it is. It's food. It's food time. But But if your wings are too heavy in it, you can't really see. It's like you have to have the pilot's perspective of when you fly into a community, that drone. This is why drone photography is so cool, because you get a visual of a place that you don't know when you're on ground. So I think it's we tend to also in our minds edit because of the negativity stuff we have. So we, you know how we are negative before we are positive a lot of times, until we deprogram ourselves or whatever. I mean, namaste on that one. But I mean, good luck on all of that, because human beings are human beings, but it's true. So we'll cut something and man, it could have been the gem of the song. And like sometimes you'll chop something. We call it killing the babies. And I talked to a death doula lately, a few weeks ago on a show, and we had to cut that out because I started talking about editing and cutting the babies, and apparently killing the babies or cutting the babies is not what you say on a show. But anyway,
right. You just said it.
But yeah, I know, but we're not talking about death, right? But if sometimes you cut out something that is actually what makes it, even if you don't like it at that point, come back to it 2 days later and you may really love that part of it. So I don't know. Sometimes we get too close to the art when you're in it, is my point.
Yeah, exactly. And I think probably nothing beats experience. You know, like when someone is an artist of any type, or probably anything actually in life, any vocation or whatever, it's like, if you just get in there and do it and do it and do it and care about it and passionate about it and pushing yourself to improve, naturally, especially if you have an inclination toward it, like it's kind of fits you, which music did since a very early age for me. I kind of knew what I wanted to do. Consciously or subconsciously, you're honing your craft. Mm-hmm. And for me, I kind of felt like I had the experience of being stuck on something and losing perspective, not knowing too close to it, or not knowing.
Yeah.
And or deciding too early. And it, you know, the one of the worst things, which would be it sounding contrived, sounding forced, you know. And I'm very picky, and I have a high standard for certain qualities that I want to achieve, because I want to offer the world, listeners, certain things that I like about mm-hmm. music. Like, let's say in the production, layers of different kinds of sounds, lyrics that have depth, that you could, but have a duality. So where you're not forcing the depth in there. It's kind of like you can, there's layers. You can just listen to it and not listen to the lyrics and it just sounds nice. Or you can think about it, or you can think about it in context of the whole story. And it's up to the listener how deep down the rabbit hole they want to go. But the writer has to build it that way. You have to think it through. And in order to do, and then, you know, little motifs and things that connect to other parts of the album, all that stuff is done in a way where I'm very careful not to, you know, put a square peg in a round hole just because I want to, you know. It's like a balance between what I want to say, what sounds good lyrically and poetically, you know, saying it in a poetic way too, not just like right on the nose all the time either.
Yeah.
All those things. And then the music and then the arrangement of it. How long should this be? How short should it be? And a lot of that goes by feel. If you've maintained this kind of, you know, balance between being close to it and not too close to it, you know, being committed to it, but still open. And then you get it, you know, chisel away. And like you said, you hope that you didn't chisel out someone's favorite part.
Too much.
I get other opinions too. Sometimes I'll play it for the musicians I'm working with or a trusted friend of mine, longtime friend of mine, Shimon Spiegel. He was the associate producer on the last two albums because he's fine because I self-produced, but it's like, all right, but let me have somebody with good ears who's really picky too. Listen to it and tell me what they think of the mix or tell me what they think of the production. Oh, you should, you know, that's a little quieter. There were a couple sections of different songs that I almost cut out. And someone said, no, don't cut that out. I love that part. And I'm like, yeah, it is good. It's good, right? And like, yeah, you got to keep it. And I'm like, all right, I'll keep it. So I don't mind, you know, a little bit of a peanut gallery, you know, just a little bit of outside objectivity thrown in there too. Because again, it's all part of the balance, you know. At the end of the day, it's a solo album, but it's a collective work with collaborations with other people. I give them their spotlight moments to solo or a feature of the song. Like there's violin from Joe Denizon who plays with Kansas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And things that are just like, it's not all about me. I could play all the instruments if I wanted to. I mean, I might do that someday just for fun, but it's kind of like, well, why when you can work with such amazing, talented musicians?
You do work with amazing people on all your different projects. You know, it's like, wow, you know, yeah, let them be who they are because it adds, it's co-creative. And as a listener, it's co-creative, right? And the dynamic that you bring in, I think from your music and just listening through, that's why I was listening through all of it. I was like, well, not all of it, but you know, going through that the other day, I was like, wow, there is a, like prog rock can be sometimes too crisp of a sound. It's so technically perfect, right? And in an album or something where it can almost be too technical and miss that, that warmth. And you've got this balance of, yeah, this is going to be exactly, you know, this is going to sound quality crisp, but you've got this warmth that is a very good balance of dynamics. And I think that is, I always listen for that. It's like, I don't want anything to hurt my ears. You know what I mean? And sometimes in prog rock, it can be just, it's almost when jazz went a little crazy kind of thing. And I love jazz and everything, but it's like, don't miss the soul part of it. And that's important with being technically good and pristine in quality of sound. If you miss the soul, it doesn't feel good. There's something that doesn't give you the namaste. Now I'm going to get into that now. Anyway. That's going to be a joke now for a while for me because I could go on a whole other story on that. But anyway, do you know what I mean about that? Where it's so technically good and pristine and especially in the recording can be like, this is the perfect sound. But if it's missing soul, it's missing soul. And
I'm probably, let's say, known as a progressive rock artist. I'm a keyboard player. My influences are Genesis, Tony Banks, and Yes, and Pink Floyd. And I have a band with members of Yes called Art of Life, and I'm in their band. And like, you know, I do a lot of stuff, Cruise to the Edge, which is, you know, but as a songwriter and as a music artist in general, I wouldn't say I'm only exactly what you think progressive rock is or should be. I look at it a little broader than that, which ironically progressive rock is supposed to be broader, a broad style. It's eclectic, bringing from different. So to me, it's kind of like, well, prog rock itself, if you define it with certain things like odd time signatures, instrumental bits and, you know, atmosphere and out of the norm structures and stuff, is just a area along the whole plane of music. But underneath it all is, for me, has to be the soul. And I don't want to sound too pretentious with that, but like, let's say it's hard to put into words exactly what it is, but like some kind of driving meaning or emotion. Magic to it,
yeah.
That is very human and that you connect with it and is genuine. Isn't like, mm-hmm. And I, you know, it's almost like it's the reason I make the albums. It's not because, mm-hmm. Hey, I'm a musician and I'm going to make albums. It's because I have the ideas. Once I have the ideas, it's my responsibility to take them to fruition. And when I've run out of ideas, I'm going to be in trouble, because then I would be maybe in a situation where I can't even imagine. I don't want to imagine.
I don't
where
think
I'm like,
you're
okay,
have
let's
that
make
problem.
Another album. No ideas, but let's just play and okay, that'll do.
Oh, because do exactly what the record label tells you to do.
Yeah. And well, I benefit from the fact that I'm not on, I have my own record label.
Yeah.
And I have, in fact, I was just thinking about this, talking to somebody about this, how I got on a kick and was listening to a bunch of really great music from the 90s. Some bands that are two bands and an artist that played together. One of them played with all three that are probably some of the best and most underknown, underrated for how great they are. Yeah. And they are Jellyfish, mm-hmm. The Grays, and Jason Faulkner. Those three made albums that are just incredible. And I was, you know, I'm friends with some of those guys, like Roger Manning was in Jellyfish. And I've asked a few questions here and there, but, you know, I didn't want to pry, like, why did you guys break up? What happened? Blah, blah, blah. So I just looked it up online and I was reading about how, first of all, this album Spilt Milk, which I was around in the studio when they were mastering that, working mm-hmm. with someone else. And, they spent apparently like $300,000 to make the record, which today would be like 600 something thousand. That doesn't happen anymore. And of course it sounds great, but when you've got that much to spend, you know, like now try to make something as lush without that. Of course you have different tools to be able to do it and everything, but that's what I try to do. Those are the mm-hmm. kind of albums that I, you know, aspire to sound like in terms of production and stuff. They're amazing. Jack Joseph Puig, you know, the producer, engineer. Anyway, so I was thinking about that and how, like, okay, The Grays, another even less known than Jellyfish, incredible. I highly recommend people check out their one album, Rochambeau. It's on the streaming services and everything. Song after song, it's just killer. It's three different songwriters: Buddy Judge, John Bryan, who's a great talent, another friend of mine, and Jason Faulkner, who was in Jellyfish and his solo stuff.
Yeah.
And so they're just, the three of them are amazing. And then they broke up. And I was like, why did they break up? What's their deal? And part of it was the album wasn't successful enough and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, of course, they probably spent a lot of money and the label didn't recoup and they were just like, dropped them and next. And it's like, that was gold. Like, you know, people say that about Sound of Contact with Matt and I and Simon yeah. Collins and stuff. And it's so, it's easy to say when you think like, why did they do it? I'm like, well, why did you do it, Dave? I'm like, we have our reasons. But still, I think to myself, even Jason Faulkner, who now plays with St. Vincent and he's played with Beck, you know, and he needs to eat. So he gets hired and he's very talented. So he gets hired big gigs like that. But then someone was telling me, I didn't actually see it myself, but on social media, like, dude, when are you going to do another solo album? And he makes these great solo albums. They're fantastic. Jason Faulkner. I love him. And he said, like, well, like, you know, I need to eat. I need to work. And, you know, I'm working on one, but it's not top priority because you guys don't buy it. Yeah. And now with streaming, it's like even less money.
Well, I noticed with this album, you only have like an EP out on Spotify and Bandcamp. Like, I was like, okay, that's smart because you're giving people a taste. But honestly, you need to listen to the whole album in its entirety for me personally, because it is a storyline. You know, go listen, but it's not the same, you know?
Well, that's the
I'm
idea.
Just one of those who like the whole thing, you know.
For my music, I tend to do, for better or worse, is just kind of my thing, these concept albums where the songs are sort of have seamless transitions into each other. And it gives you a really cool album listening experience, which is almost in some ways a dying art. You know, people are a little bit more single oriented, and I'm still stuck on like, no, but
I
something
think
about
back.
An album.
It's coming back because vinyl's coming back. And I think the vinyl push may help. And then I was talking to a musician the other day, John Dawson, and they're doing cassettes. And I'm like, dude, seriously. And he's like, well, there's very few of them because it's so
expensive.
That's
a novelty, and it's cute and fun. Even vinyl to me is still a novelty. It's fun, but you have to change the side. It's still not a seamless experience, actually. You have to at least change the side, and you get clicks and pops. But it's fun. It's just nostalgia, and for younger generation, it's a charm. There's a charm to it. It's cool, and you know, there's vinyl enthusiasts. I think it is great for that kind of. You know what's great about it is thinking of music as a collection, because to me, an album has weight to it in the sense that it's like, okay, that's that year with that artist that he did or they did this collective work, as opposed to a song, which can happen popcorn anytime, whatever, which is still cool. But there's something about even versus an EP. An EP is a light version of an album, but an album is kind of a milestone in terms of a creative statement.
It's like writing a book. It is like writing a book to me, a novel. An album
versus
is
a
like
short
that.
Story.
You want... Exactly. It is. And that much, that amount of work that goes into it. And it has to be co-created if you're getting other people involved, which most writers have to do that too. But
Since I do albums like that, because of the genre, because of that approach, I'm experimenting with this idea of not giving away the farm on all the streaming services like most everyone does. And I sort of feel slightly, I have mixed feelings about it because I feel bad that my whole album isn't on all those platforms for people to just listen to. But there is this exact, you nailed it, which is pretty much like, well, the idea is you can listen to 6 songs out of the 14 of the album. They don't have seamless transitions. They're standalone. They aren't edited this time. On the Traveler singles, I did an EP. They were edited as well, a little bit shorter. But these are the full length, but they don't have those transitions, and they're just half the album, but it's a good enough, if for some people, it's like kind of like the highlights and the cliff notes or, you know, like this is the gist of it. But the idea is if you like that, and you want more, then you go buy the album like the good old days. And that's the only way artists like myself and many, many others can afford to do that, because we have to recoup the expense of time and money to make these. They don't just make themselves. So, you know, I'm a big proponent for trying to not only help listeners understand how important it is, especially for indie artists, but maybe the whole industry. But like if you're Taylor Swift, it doesn't affect as much because there's millions and millions, millions of billions of streams. But niche artists like jazz or prog or things that aren't mass popular, it just doesn't add up. It's a fraction of a penny per stream. So the way around it is if you like an artist, you buy their album or you buy their t-shirt or go to the shows or whatever it is. But like, think like, okay, I need to support. It's like you're voting with your wallet for the kind of music you want to exist, because it won't exist anymore if we don't, you know. But anyway.
Yeah, and music is far more important than politicians. Let me not get started, but we need it because of the politicians. It's like, okay, we need something else.
We need an escape.
We do need that escape. But Bandcamp just sold, didn't they? Did I read that right? That they just sold. So they were like at one point the only decent, you know. So
they still
who knows?
Are for now.
Well, we'll see. Yeah. So it's kind of a we'll see. But it is a weird world for anyone in the creative arts, authors dealing with Amazon and that crap. I mean, I think everyone, even with what we do, it's like, oh, we need to put ads on every little thing, and we work with our own people. And it's like, no matter what, it's a wild west out there. And hopefully one day we can, I just say we all work together and make it like, you know, vote for it, like you're saying. Going back to prog rock, I wanted to talk about that. With that soul part of it, right? I also feel like all the, because I remember, you know, starting interviewing, you know, prog rock artists, and I'm like, what exactly is this? Because I hear all these different things, and I'm, you know, I'm the blend. I don't care, like, really about labels. But what I have noticed, and I've asked this of other people, and they think I'm weird, but it's okay. It's not just the sound of prog rock. From what I've noticed from all the musicians that are in that genre or that label, that the progressive part is not just the music. It is about the lyrics. It is about the message and the story that is sending out, that is more of a progressive, caring kind of message in some way. Like, a, you know, it could be, you know, hey, we're trying to lift some voices on, or some shine a light on an issue or something like that. But it seems that there's a higher sensibility of what is going out musically and the messaging behind the music. Is it just me and what I've heard? Or what do you think about that?
I mean, obviously every artist and band is different and has their Sure. own kind of thing. But to me, I look at it sort of like, both in my own music and some of the music I like of modern progressive rock, as a combination of nostalgia and pushing the envelope to offer something new to add to the, you know, expansion of progressive music in terms of any of the areas. Like, okay, well, here's a different angle. So, because, you know, some people expect, you know, and it rarely happens, but you to like reinvent the wheel, and it's like, it should be completely new and original. And like, you know, and I sometimes get sort of criticized for sounding a lot like Pink Floyd or sounding like the Beatles or this and that. And it's just like, well, I'm intentionally using those influences as part of my palette. And I want nostalgia as part of it. I want you to, I want to keep some of those things I like about those bands alive. But
yeah, carry
for
the
me
torch.
To do it,
yeah.
For me to do a good job, I need to add something new to it. I need to blend it in a different way so it isn't exactly like a second-rate Pink Floyd song or something. And I think none of it is. I could argue every single song that sounds anything like this band or that band, I could say, well, they'd never do that because it gets fast here, and they wouldn't, you know, or there's, or like with Pink Floyd, because the song, you know, a lot of times my voice is a lot like David Gilmour's, and, you know, people make that reference. And that's, it's kind of like saying, you look too much like Brad Pitt. Like, I wouldn't mind. So, but you sound like Pink Floyd. It's like, well, I love Pink Floyd. So thank you. But the thing is Pink Floyd would never write about this romantic stuff that I write about and breakups and everything. Their idea of a breakup is beat to a pulp on a Saturday
yeah, I was
night.
Gonna say, here
okay?
it goes. Yeah,
you know,
I'm
you
gonna
know,
get going.
like,
I've got
this
like
is
the
a very
wall.
different, you know, subject matter typically. And but the other thing is, like you said, like lyrically, it's another area to me to progress. And I actually learned that from Kevin Gilbert, because he was also really into prog, and he did this kind of alt rock pop, but infused with prog elements. But what he did that made an impression on me was, you know, a lot of the prog that we like from the 70s, some of the lyrics are a little bit out of reach, a little inaccessible. Like, you don't really know, they're maybe talking about a little mouse or something, or like a purple wolfhound, whatever that is, or, you know, mythical creatures and things that are
tricky.
You know, cool fantasy, but not necessarily something that you can relate to or something that necessarily makes sense. And I even asked John Anderson one time about a Yes song, and he was giving me this whole like explanation, like, well, Dave, you know, the harmonic convergence and all that. And then he goes, well, actually, Dave, we were just really high. It was the 70s.
Exactly.
And I'm like, oh, all right. Okay. That's the
so there
off
was
the record.
A don't eat the purple berries, you know?
Yeah. And that's fair enough. That's fine too. But in order to, let's say, change it a little bit, what if it was accessible? What if it was something that you could follow and relate to and also laugh and all these other elements of storytelling and you know, like breaking the fourth wall and all these things. And again, Kevin kind of, you know, taught me that by what he did. And I was like, well, that's new. That's fun. Mm-hmm. Like, why not? You know, and of course, country music does that. But sometimes country music's just a little not poetic enough. Maybe it's just too on the nose. Like, and people generally like it because they relate to it. Like, yeah, I had a beer. I grabbed a beer and I did that too. You know, it's like, well, what if there's somewhere in the middle between prog and mainstream rock or country or blues or all those kinds of things that people relate to? And right there, to me, that's making some progress. Thinking Man's music, but that isn't so clever that it's like over your head or so obscure that it's that you can't relate to it.
I think people are tired of so much constant information, you know, through social media, the news, all the drama in the world. So an escape shouldn't be work, you know? It shouldn't be. And but you do want the element of surprise. You want to go on the album, hear it, then go back, go, oh, I didn't hear this part. Like the first, you want it to have those layers that you were talking about earlier, because then it stays fresh. And it is cool to have sounds from the past, because how do we keep that flame going? You know what I mean? It's like, I feel that way about the blues strongly.
Great example.
To keep that, you know, to keep that flame going, like, so that we don't lose that cultural root section of music. And I don't think we ever will, but it's like, you want to keep that going and with integrity too. You know, so like country has changed a lot. Country now to me is like pop rock. It's like, I don't know who's a country artist or not. Chris Stapleton to me sounds like an R&B singer, like an old school good R&B singer. So I have no clue, apparently. It's okay with me. You know,
I think
it's what people like, you know?
As an artist, it's great to be able to filter everything, all those styles through your eyes, through your vision of it. And I like things about folk and country. I generally don't like to listen to it. Maybe Johnny Cash or something like that. But there's my version of it, like what I would do. And then within the context of what I really like, which is rock and roll, and just kind of, and I'm certainly not the only one to do that. The Beatles and Led Zeppelin had their folksy moments, and Pink Floyd as well. And I always liked the way they would bring those elements into a different context. And then it became like something that someone like me would like, you know, because it's, you know, pushes the envelope a little bit. It's like, all right, it's eclectic. And, but yeah, I think it's all a matter of, interpretation. Like if all the knowledge of music before that came before is your foundation of influence, your foundation, your reference point, you know, like when we talk to each other, it's like, kind of like a Bonamy beat, you know, and we kind of know what that means. It means, you know, hit it hard and, you know, or a Ringo thing, a little shuffle. And, when you know, it's all about doing it in a way that you make it your own. It's authentic. Mm-hmm. And I've always liked that, like bands like Tears for Fears, you know, Sowing the Seeds of Love, very Beatlesy, but it's very Tears for Fears. It's unique to them. And I love that stuff. So, but it's there's an art to that, I guess. Some people can do it and it just sounds like a copy. And then some people will only hear it as a copy because they don't really...
Sometimes it's a tribute. What is okay? All that's happening in my brain right now, other than listening to you, like you keep talking about Pink Floyd, and now all I can hear is see Emily play. Like, what the heck? Like, why my head went there? But it was an element of surprise for me hearing that, because I hadn't heard that. I'd heard, you know, everything else, but then all of a sudden here I am with see Emily play, and I'm like, wow, okay. So it was like an element of surprise, you know what I mean? And it was almost Beatlish to me.
They were heavily. I mean, Dark Side of the Moon has very Beatlesy moments.
Yeah,
Across the Universe came before that. Da, na, 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 na. But that's just how even the Beatles borrowed from Little Richard and the Beach Boys and all sorts of people.
Yeah.
So that's just how it works. But I'm a little bit more transparent and honest about it. And confident in the sense that I know what I'm doing and I know I'm aware of when it's gone too far or if it's just a second-rate copy. I wouldn't do it if it didn't have a purpose. Like, for instance, the song Dirty Girl.
I like that, album. By the way. I like that song. That's funny. And I like that.
So it's got this kind of like Eagles-ish, you know, Life in the Fast Lane vibe or whatever. And then it goes to this middle section that goes full on Beatles-y. And that bit I wrote now. So that song I've been sort of unfinished and the middle section I wrote, because, you know, when you take an album like Sgt. Pepper, there was something about the Beatles in that era that was kind of whimsical and like a carnival, you know, like, and it's sort of, and it fit the comedy of this song about this girl who would take strangers back to her place when her parents weren't there. And like, it was a strict religious household, it seemed like. It was a true story. And you would think like, okay, parents are away, the cat's away, the mice play, or whatever kind of a thing. And it was just funny, the situation. And so it was the perfect backdrop for every week it's the same, someone else. And like, do you want to be that guy? I mean, because, you know, you just got out of a relationship.
Everybody knows.
You know, do you go for it? I didn't end up going for it. So in the song, I make it sound like a punishment. That's like, if you're not going to go along this, you can go. There's the door. You know, you can sleep outside. The truth is, I asked to sleep outside because her little brother was there and I didn't want to fool. I'm a stranger. Like, the whole thing was weird in their home. But the reason I wanted to sleep outside is because it was gorgeous. And I'm sure you've seen this traveling around. No light pollution. You could see every star. And I'm kind of like a city boy. So for me, I was like, I even said to her, I'm like, you want to come outside or whatever? She's like, no. I'm like, it's gorgeous. Like, you're spoiled. You don't even know how. And so I stayed out all night in a little sleeping bag. And it was actually amazing. Very just powerful to see all the, like, the Milky Way. I mean, it was incredible. It was in Utah. And, but anyway, so that's how I see those things. It's like, there's a reason, you know, like it just works musically, or just kind of like it's a dynamic, it's a color.
But you add the element of surprise, and there's a lot of quirkiness, like the stories. There's sarcasm, hard truths, and just some like, what? You know, you just go, what did he just say? You know, that kind of thing, which is cool. I think that's what makes a good album. Are you going to, so volume one, so what's volume two look like? Is that in production, or are you?
Most of
your
it's
way
written.
Of saying, I'll finish this now?
Oh, no, I most of it's recorded and written. I'll have it done for early next year.
Awesome.
But the interesting thing about volume two is really the tie-in with writing it now. What happened was a guy named Eric Nielsen and I drove around the country filming the drive, which I used for the Blu-ray, for the videos coming up.
Yeah.
And we have some great footage, and we captured it in like panoramic. And, while we were doing that, about 4 or 5 years ago, whatever, I was in this phase of a little taste of a midlife crisis, in the sense that I was dating a girl much younger than me, which I don't do anymore. But, you know, at the time I was sort of in denial of my age and just going through those things that you might go through as a late 40s, 50, early 50s, you know, just, you know. Anyway, so
I have no clue about any of that at all. It's hitting.
Oh, well, you're lucky.
It's hitting. No, I'm just being sarcastic as hell. I mean, I think everybody in this age group, they're all going, what the hell just happened? Like, it's almost like it just, somebody turned a switch and said, oh yeah, watch this. You didn't think it was going to happen? It is.
As a rock musician, you get an extra pass to be a kid, to be a big kid.
Yeah.
And you think like, oh, well, you know, whatever. And so I had this girlfriend at the time, and she was too young and, you know, and to be serious about. And I even was like trying to not take it seriously, like being like, okay, well, we'll just have fun, whatever. I'm single, so sure, why not? And then I'm a monogamous type of person. So I fell for her. And then, you know, she broke up with me. And she should, because I was too old, but this wasn't going to work out. I mean, my mom, her husband was, I think, like 20 years older than her, but he died. And I guess it worked for them. But for me, it was just kind of like, it just wasn't really right. But anyway, it didn't stop me from getting my heart broken again while I'm on the drive. Wasn't the same impact. Obviously, she wasn't my fiance, and it wasn't. But the irony is that it was, strangely enough, a good thing in terms of getting back into the headspace of being sad, getting your heart broken, not seeing the, you know, like, why did I fall for her when I knew this was trouble? It wasn't going to work. But it's like, yeah, but once you start to, you know, open up with someone and let them in and everything, you know, you start to love them and get attached. And then it's like, oh, getting out of this is can be painful. And, you know, it's like, and again, so it was like another lesson of like, yeah, be careful dabbling. If you're going to dabble, like, I don't dabble anymore. You know, I waited, actually. I was very picky before. I had a whole year where I was with no one. And then finally I met my current girlfriend, and it was like, all right, that was worth waiting for, instead of just kind of, well, let me give this a half-hearted try. And it's like, before you know it, you're stuck in something that was never really compatible for, you know. So anyway, of course, you could wait around forever for Mr. Right or Mrs. Right, and you know, there's that too. But either way, I don't know if I have the answers, but for myself or for anyone else.
Hey, but you're good now. He's all right now.
I have some lessons of just kind of like, well, if you dabble, you might fall in love and get hurt. So just beware. If you want to do it anyway, go for it. But so that's what volume two is a bit more about. It's about the drive, remembering the drive. So there's those two layers. Even this album is in the sense that I'm writing it as a, you know, like the beginning starts with the song True Story. It's like, wrote an album that no one's never heard. So you're hearing very, direct from me. Like you're hearing the album, thinking about writing the album that you're hearing. So, but there is also, and you'll, in volume two, you'll understand it in more, of the present moment, or not present now, but present when I was, revisiting the album and writing it and driving cross country again, is how I feel about those things and how some of those things still happen in a different way as a mid 40s, early 50s, midlife crisis kind of thing, where you're like, okay, I'm divorced and I'm going to go have some fun. And they're like, well, just be careful. The same things apply. Pick well, because you could, and know that you could get hurt if you just kind of too casual about things or whatever. And, yeah, so I touch on that, and musically, it's, there's a little bit of a tie-in from with the first record, which is fun. But then there's a lot of new stuff that's just like starts to go expanding the road trip of like different,
you know, moves. We like this. Oh yeah. I mean, the road is freeing, but cruel at the same time. Like, there's, you know, being on the road full time, it is, there's just some moments where you do have, like, I think that's why I like Manic Calm, because you could go through like insane traffic, like in Little Rock. What are you doing lately? But I mean, and then, you know, almost die. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, calm, you know, on the road. And, you know, there's this thing. And I think there's something, the road, if you're a driver, you really are just you and the road. You know what I mean? And whoever's around you, you're not really 100% engaged in the conversation, because it's your head and the wheel and the ahead of you. And I think you really get to think things out, and maybe even have to go to the places you didn't want to think. Like, we are all good at just shelving it, because we have all these things we have to do in life and shelve it. But on the road, what else are you going to do other than music? Thank God, especially Texas. I'm about to do that, man. I'm like, don't make me drive through Dallas again. I'm looking at every alternative, because please don't make me go through there again. It's 4 hours of traffic. You know it is. But, you know, there is something about the road trips that it's like ironing in a way. It's like ironing your clothes. Not that I know how to do that.
It's like, you know, it's like everything. Reading a book. You read a book and it's not spoon-fed to you. Your imagination is involved. And with driving, it's kind of like you said, there isn't much to do but think and listen to music and look and see what you see.
Oh, God, look at everything. Yeah, yeah.
And what you see can be dramatic. It could be absolutely stunning mountains and, you know, canyons and just, you know, sunsets and beautiful things. And then it can also be brutal, like a storm, and you can barely see, you know, 5-10 feet in yeah. front of you. And you're like, I hope I get through this alive. And it's kind of like an analogy for life and the journey of life. And, you know, it's been done. I'm not saying this is like a new thought here,
but I've always liked it.
I've always liked cross country movies and these things where it's like, man, if you have to trek it, you know, and you're going to go through ups and downs and you're going to go through these different range of feelings. And, but you know, it's to me, a really good, it's a good basis for a concept album, except for even more so for me because I did it. And so I'm writing about my own story doing that. But I always liked, driving. When I came to LA, I drove cross country from Florida. I live in Florida now.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I've always been, because, you know, also it's kind of funny when you're a music lover. It's like, oh man, it's 4 hours. No, it's not. It's four albums. Vegas is 4 albums away from LA. Oh, it's just 4 albums away. Let's go.
That's so funny because like I even like clock gas money according to hours, like not by gallons, but by hours. Uh-huh. Like if it's this many hours, this is this much gas. I don't know why, but it's like weird, but it is. Well, I'm going to be listening on this trek across. So when this airs, we would have just landed. Even though we're driving, not flying, but it'll be interesting to listen, even though we're going the other direction. You know, there will be tumbleweeds. It's that season. Everybody needs a good tumbleweed. And sometimes you get those haboob things out in Arizona too. Those little wind tunnels of dirt. And we've been through hurricanes. We've driven through just about everything.
Wow.
So it's fun, but music is part of it. And you're right about the analogy for life. If people looked at it that way, life is more, it's a game almost. It's like, to me, I'm starting to think life is like a game show.
you know, when you're driving in a storm and if you've driven in a hurricane, that's the extreme of it. And I've been in hurricanes living in Florida and stuff. But especially driving where you're in a vulnerable, you're just in this little vehicle and, you know, you're the windshield wipers and trying to see.
Yeah.
And you think like, well, you got to weather the storm, the expression. It's literally, life is like that sometimes, where sometimes when it rains, it pours, another expression, it's like things are tough financially, emotionally, whatever it is, you know. And it's important to remember that you'll get through it, that there's going to be a sunny day at the end of that. Like you just have to stick it out. And that's a lot of like Too Far Gone, Keep Moving On, Soon You Will Come Back to Life. And that is kind of like the older self talking to the younger self, if I could have, and say, look, just keep going. It'll be fine. You know, pick yourself up and you'll get to happier days. And I think, but you know, it seems like a cliche, but it's actually just very, very common amongst maybe all of us, where we're down and need a pickup, need a reminder, need a kind of like, look, I know it's terrible. People like to commiserate for better or worse, but it's kind of like, just hang in there because you'll see a brighter day. You just will. It just, the ebb and flow of life. That's how it is, you know, but don't be defeated to nothing when it's bad. Mm-hmm. You just have to kind of, you know, and that to me, because it was pretty bad at the time. I mean, I got over it, but like, you know, it's embarrassing. You know, so this is my fiance. You tell your family and everything, and they're like, really? That's kind of quick. And you're like, oh no, when it's the one, you know, it's the one. And I'm repeating her words, and then she pulls a 180 on me, and I'm like, forget what I said. I don't know. Don't even talk to me. I need to just drive and think about this because I don't know what, just my rug just got pulled out from underneath, and I don't know what's going on. But the idea of just kind of moving anyway felt good. I remember one time I was in a breakup and she cheated on me, and I knew that she did. And I asked her, because she was acting all mean and weird, this other girl. And in LA, in fact, this was like the final straw for me to leave LA. I was like, I don't want to deal with people like this. She left me for like a Ferrari driving multimillionaire dude. So it was like the classic, like,
oh boy.
And, but I said, are you seeing somebody or something going on? And then she goes, yes, I admit it. And then broke up with me. And I'm like, it just was such a shock that I literally just sat home and cried all weekend, because I knew she went away to Palm Springs with the guy for that weekend. It's pretty harsh and cruel. It was painful. I'll never forget that. Just sitting there, I should have just got out of the car and drove, but you can't do it all the time. But this was like, you know, the difference between a little bit of manic calm, but driving through canyons and seeing beautiful things and listening to music, versus just sitting there imagining your girlfriend is in Palm Springs, you know, with some guy, and like you just found out, was excruciatingly painful, you know, for at least a weekend or a week or whatever it took me.
Yeah, everybody has those where I did a drive once, and this thing that had been escalating between me and this guy is still a very dear friend, but you know, just like no matter how beautiful it was, it just realistically was not going to work. And it came to that realization, because apparently I travel and do my own thing, and no, you can't have my business, and no, I'm not selling my business, and no, you won't tell me what to do and when to answer a phone. It was like one of these brutal things, but yet in your mind and your emotions, this was like perfection, right? But it wasn't. It just came down to brass tacks. And I remember going, well, this really sucks. And I drove home, and I think we were living in Joshua Tree at the time, and I drove from the Bay Area down through the mountain passes, and I was crying. I was driving to Sacramento. It was like November or December or something. And they were closing the roads as I was heading down these mountain passes into like Lone Pine. And I ended up at Mono Lake, like seriously going down this mountain pass. So I was Lee Vining area. And I swear to God, like I was listening to the same album over, I think it was like Bob Dylan and all kinds of, I was listening to stuff like, get me through this, get me through this. I'm upset. And yet a snowstorm is coming. But then of course, the side of me is like, well, this is cool. I'm going to get stuck in the snow. I know how to drive through the snow. I can do this down a mountain pass. There was a full moon and a sunset that was pink on the mountains with the snow. And there was a moon shining over Mono Lake. Wow. And I was like, I don't need this dude anymore. Screw this. I've got like a moonset over Mono Lake. This is the most epic thing. And it was, you know, and I'm trying to drive, and Nancy's like trying to call him, like, I don't know where I am. And then drive through the desert. I mean, I was on the road all night. By the time I got home, I was like, I'm done. I'm okay now. I'm fine. But there's that moment. But I saw this amazing that it'll, and I always put those two, like, this is just what happened. And then here's this magical moment I've always had. And that's what you're always chasing on the road, is those moments. And you go through some bad things too, like homeless areas. And we could do shows on what we see across this country. And that's why we do what we do. But you've got to go through the crap to get to the good. And sometimes you start with the good and have to go through the crap. But wherever you start on the cycle of birth, on this physical plane, you're going to go through it. And that, I'll never forget that moment ever. Because it's still one of the most magical things I've ever experienced.
Well, I was going to say that, and actually that's primarily what the album and this series of albums are about, is that we have these relationships where we take risks and we get involved with somebody, and they have their baggage and they have their traits and our incompatibilities, and we have ours as well.
That's a good one, incompatibilities. I like that word. That's a good one.
Yeah. And they rear their ugly head at a certain point, like whatever it may be, and something, let's say, breaks, and it's painful, can be painful. And the healing solutions, the variety of things that are out there are the options. One of them would be, let's say, a rebound, which is probably not a good idea, but that's what Dirty Girl would be like. Oh, I can just forget my troubles and be with some new person. But the ones that are just, you can't argue with, are undeniably healing, are things like nature and the beauty of nature, and especially like, so like nature itself, but then a moment like that, a moonset, a mono lake, that's priceless. That's like, dude, you, it's only happening right then, that and particular snow. Thing. And snow and all that stuff.
Boom.
The universe has a way of showing up through things like that in moments of despair. And it's incredible. And it's healing. And of course, the other thing is music and the hypnotic movement of driving forward. Like when you talk about traffic, I hate traffic. I think pretty much everyone does. But the main reason I hate it is stop, go. And like, but when they're out of the way and I can just go, it's awesome. You know, it's like just moving on, you know, and all of those things, you know, when you combine, especially so for the drive, the best parts of the drive were, you know, not pulling over and calling to see if you could talk it out. It's like, well, you got slammed on that one. And, you know, the rebound idea, bad idea. At least I didn't go for it and didn't cause more trouble in my head. But the best parts were the beautiful things I saw on the drive, the time to myself, music, space. And there were those magic nature moments. I remember one time I just sat, I pulled over and watched the sunset in some random place. And that was beautiful. And then another thing, there's a place, you probably know it. It's called Lookout Mountain, I think it is. And it looks like the Grand Canyon, but it's not publicized. There's like a sign, I think maybe along the 10, between California and Texas, somewhere in there, where you could pull over and sightsee there. But there's no commercial, there's no shops, there's nothing, right? So you go there, and there might be another driver, group of people there. But when I went, there was no one. And you just stood on top of this like mountain and could see all these canyons, kind of like the Grand Canyon, but like even more
barren.
That's
between Lubbock and Dallas. It's between Lubbock and Dallas, I believe. And it's if you went off the one interstate thing to go on the side road.
I knew you'd know.
And it's like fingers. It's like fingers. Like,
yes.
Almost like Anza Borrego. Like,
and it's like you're looking at, I thought of so many things. It's like you're looking at, in fact, Ghost Written Fables, the song The Traveler, was inspired by that. Which is the idea in that song, I'm a time traveler in sci-fi version. And I go into the future where there's no more humans. And that looks like you're looking at prehistoric Earth. You really are, actually.
You are. Yeah, you are.
Or life without people. And it was so deep because it was kind of like you had respect for the Earth that kind of just like endures our craziness for this little blip of time that it's been around,
right?
And it's like patience.
It's humbling. It's humbling because it reminds you like how small we are and then how big it is. But I think also about the album and see, when I talked about the progressive nature of prog rock, this is what I'm talking about. It's like there's a hope. There's always a sense of hope or moving forward, and there's a positive light in the music. That's what I've been from, you know, what we've been listening to. But road tripping, so when you have a breakup, especially if you're living with someone and you're knee deep and, you know, here's the noose around your neck kind of thing, you're going through, like, and they break up, the rug's pulled out. So not only it's your comfort zone's been taken away as well, on top of it all. And the road is like, and when you go on the road, it's almost like, oh, if I'm going to have a change, this is my way of controlling my change, even though you know anything can happen, but you're setting yourself up to know and to trust yourself. And being on the road and travel is about trusting yourself, because any situation can happen at any time, like whether you're driving or not. How are you going to handle that? If, you know, it's a storm or whatever it is. It's like being live on stage. Anything can freaking happen at any time. You have to trust yourself in that moment to be present, aware, and handle it. And so in that way, travel, when you go through something big in life, and it's and it, like all the movies that you're talking about, like, you know, road trip movies, whatever it is, there's something about it. It's where you kind of regain, you overcome fear of routine, getting past routine, creating something non-routine. Even it's like a weird thing of us being open to all kinds of change and putting ourselves back in our place of trusting ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of sayings like you're in the driver's seat, or, you know,
I'm always in the driver's seat in the car.
Yeah. Well, it's your kind of, it is analogous to, like, you know, taking your power back, or at least putting things in your hands, your fate in your hands, or your journey, or, you know, where you're going. It's like you're guiding your own destiny in that moment, of just as opposed to, let's say, allowing yourself to wallow or have a victim mentality of like,
I've been
screwed over and I'm going to stay here and stagnate and eat pretzels or whatever.
Watch
Lord of the Rings. although I did in the pandemic, I watched the entire extended Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, but that was the pandemic. But other than that, get in the car and drive, and be open for new things. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the cool things about, we're speaking, it's like, you know, preaching to the choir, like, you and I both love nature and we love driving. And so, you know, not everybody does that, but I do think, you know, it can be liberating for people to just get out of the box. You know, we live in these boxes, you know, even just getting outdoors sometimes.
So hiking is even better, because, like, you know, that's the whole other thing. It's like, but you also see, like, this country, like, just if we're even just talking about this country, and you can go everywhere around the world, right? Well, not everywhere right now. We as this country have so many different communities that are so different to where we may live now, right? And to see, get off the interstate, go off on the little road, see how communities are, drive, like for us, like for me, I love to drive through a community as the sun's rising. And most of the time we want to be where the sun's rising so we can get into nature and see the animals and everything. But to see a town wake up or a town go to sleep, you wonder who's in that house. Are they drinking coffee? If so, give me some. I'm like, half of the time I want to pull over and say, hey, I'm here. I want more coffee, please. You know, but there's like, you want to know, are do their kids go to the local school? Like, what's their story? Like, if I could knock on people's doors as we traveled, I would, because I want to know.
I wish that life was, and this could be just my perspective, as safe and friendly as that. I think to some extent it is. And then to a large extent, people just have issues with each other that are
someone drives up on your driveway. What the hell? Here comes the guns. You know, we've done some of those on the road. Oopsie. There's certain places in Tennessee you don't want to be driving.
But I remember traveling in like Europe, and you like a total stranger. There's like people outside having a dinner, like in Spain or Italy or Greece, a place like that, and they're so warm, and it's like, oh, come join us.
Yeah.
And they're having like this amazing dinner, and you're like, oh, okay, you know, and it's beautiful. I wish the whole world was like that, where people could just share their community and their style of cooking and their
we do traditions. Have it. We do have it. It's come back a little bit. We were last year in Michigan. I didn't think Wisconsin or Michigan. My best friend from high school flew over here, and I haven't seen her since we left South Africa, and it was like this big deal. It's been apparently 30, whatever year it is. She gets here with her daughter, and her daughter is connected with this other family, and they rented a house. We all went to this house, and all the family members started appearing at this little house on the water. We didn't know anybody other than my friend Melissa and I, and you know, we're all family to each other, you know, and it was crazy. We were all different political views. I learned how to play cornhole. I mean, people just brought food and everybody, it was just one of those, it felt like I was back in South Africa, actually, like this backyard style of everybody just hanging out, having a couple drinks, playing cornhole, which I've been laughing about since I ever heard the word. I mean, who called it cornhole? Sorry, but that's really funny as hell. Like, it took me for years. I had a friend who used to come on representing Kentucky on shows, and they kept going, "Why do they laugh when they say cornhole?" And she says, "Well, because Lisa and Nancy are from California." They could get away. But anyway, I finally learned that. But it was this sense of we do have it, and we've seen it. And I think because the way we travel, we're always immersed with people in their homes and stuff. So it's different. So don't give up hope on that. It is there, but it's just different. And we have to do it in different ways. And I think music and concerts put people together.
Well, that, I was thinking about possibly doing. A good friend of mine does this all the time, Francis Dunnery, and he even wrote a book about it, house concerts. And some other friends have done it. That could be a way to try to connect with people and also bring the music into it and offer something, especially with an album like this, and the whole album series, it's kind of intimate anyway, storytelling, it can be done acoustically. So that's something that I might explore, and it'd be more traveling and travelogue, along with it. But the irony is that that's stepping outside of my box, because my box is this, and I don't mind being the mad scientist with the knobs and, making the music and producing, because I do almost everything in terms of mixing, mastering, video editing, and that whole thing. And it's very time consuming. But I have that duality where I like to be in my little cave, my man cave, or whatever you want to call it. And then I love nature and I love people and I love to kind of, I love, in fact, my favorite part of music. I was talking about this recently with somebody too. And of course, I could say this in my 50s. Who knows what it would have been like if I was successful as a musician, really successful, like some winning Grammys and platinum records. I have friends who did that when they were in their 20s, but I didn't. Record companies rejected me.
But you became your own entrepreneur, which I think rejection leads to some strength. Honestly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I have no, it probably was a good thing. But the wisdom of being able to see what the value is of what I'm trying to do. Is it to have as many people as possible tell me compliments and to win awards and to big my ego up to where I feel like validated or something, or feel kind of like important or whatever it is, famous, it's like, no. In fact, I talk about that even in the song where one of the first songs, Dreaming in LA, is like, was actually thinking about that when I left LA. I was like, why am I here? Do I need to be famous? Do I really need to be famous? Or do I just want to be a music artist and have my stuff out there and reach to connect with the people? And so that's what it's all about for me is, it requires success financially because it costs money to make and we got to live and eat. So, and I wouldn't mind certainly if it was massively successful, if that's even possible anymore in the music industry. But, and as far as fame as a utility, if it means more people know who we are or know who I am so they can buy concert tickets when I come into town, then it's useful. If it's so that people look at me weird everywhere I go, it's a little annoying. Yeah. I know people like Phil Collins can't even have a dinner without people interrupting his dinner to take a picture, have an autograph, like everywhere he goes for his whole life.
That would be hard. That would be really hard. They'd have to put a muzzle on me because I would tell people,
even when you try to be incognito, you look like a person trying to be incognito. You must be famous.
Yeah, it's hard because you want to do the indoor. Nancy and I call it the indoor outdoor. Indoor, we're in the creative mode, writing and doing all the wizardry kind of stuff. Then all of a sudden, we have to be out and about. People, we're like, okay, we can't do two in the same day. It's really difficult unless I'm creating at night. Then it's fine. Everyone's gone, and I can create at night. But that indoor outdoor thing is really difficult to be. Your energy is going to people, right? So it's like a concert. It's
well, that's
creative.
What it's all about. Yeah. Is your connection to people and giving them something to listen to on their drive, something to listen to on the way to work, something to listen to when they're working out with their AirPods, something to help them through a breakup or and inspire them. you know, music, as we were saying earlier, you almost can't go a day without hearing music somewhere, even if you're just shopping and there's music in the background. Music kind of keeps us going, and it's like a vibration, you know, massager, you know, healing. Musicians are like healers in a weird way. It's important part of life. It is to certain people. It's definitely to me. It's therapy, exactly.
It is, and vibration.
Yeah, it's vibration. We need it. And that's why we need, in my opinion, like we need new music, because there's great music from the 60s and the 70s. I talk about this a lot, but it's like, if you're only listening to that, it's great, but you're stagnating. You need new fuel. You need something new to think
about.
Can
you talk to all the radio stations across the country? If you're not in a college town, it sucks. I hate Hotel California now, and I never did. It's a brilliant song, but it's like, we count it, like we could hear it 3 times a day on the road. Yeah. It's like, and they keep the same. And I'm like, that, if you're going to do the Eagles, they've got so much more. I mean, why don't you do Seven Bridges Road? Nobody plays that. I mean, that's amazing harmony. You know, like no one does that, you know, play the B side of the album for God's sakes, for once, you know, it's God, I feel like the radio and I know there's a lot of independent stations, but when you're traveling, maybe I'm keeping on our car, Mulva Cleopatra Doppelganger is her name. she has a CD player and I'm holding on to her for that reason. And I'm not like, I'm just weird about it. That vibe of, you know, just, I don't know. You can't listen to the radio anymore unless you have all the digital stuff, I suppose. Like, I don't know, but I feel like we need to go back and there should be a road. I mean, if there was a way for us to do it, I would do it. I have a road trip channel that goes across the country that people
That'd
can listen
great.
To. Wouldn't it be
well,
cool?
There's
like
so
new
many
songs?
Styles, but yeah. I think the important thing is that there's just new fuel. And again, it's like when I think about it, it's not from the perspective of me personally, I need help. I'm begging for people to buy albums or do whatever it's like, or to listen to my music and be open-minded. Even though sometimes in the prog world, I have to kind of remind people, like, just be open-minded and listen to new music, whether it's me or Big Train or Matt Dorsey's
thrive
music.
On it,
you know,
man.
Anyway, there's music being made that is really good. And but the thing is, it's not about that. It's about the more broad kind of how music fits in with people's lives and what it can do. If, like you said, Hotel California is a brilliant song, but if that's all you listen to, you're kind of staying in the same place. Whereas, if you listen to new music, that new album from Tears for Fears or Porcupine Tree or whoever it is could be like, that's reminds me of that summer because I was listening to that.
Yeah.
And it could be an old album too, but at least it's new to you. It's not just Stairway to Heaven again. You know, it's like a B-side or a deep cut or something you haven't heard from them or a solo album or whatever. But especially to me, like new music where it's like, well, no one's heard it before. Like my new album, it just came out. No one's heard it before. Lift you up. It may, you know, be a great
I like it. I can't wait.
Road.
I'm going to tell you how it goes on the road trip. I can't wait for that because it's like two different listening experiences. One sitting with a headset and just listening versus being on the road. It'll be interesting. So I'll try and time it that we get to the tumbleweed place at the right time. But Dave, I got to run. It's been such a pleasure having you back on
Likewise.
The show. Don't wait so many years next time. Get the next album out. But everyone go to DaveKersner.com. Is that the best place for them to get things and connect?
Sure.
Instagram. I know you do a lot on Instagram too, and get geeky on Instagram too. Like for all the music people.
My Bandcamp is called SonicElements.bandcamp.com.
That's a good place too to get it.
Yeah, you can go there through my website, though, DaveKersner.com. So make it
all
easy.
Right. Awesome. And we want to give a shout out for our sponsor today, the National Parks Arts Foundation. We love them. They create these amazing artist residencies for musicians, painters, poets, writers, whatever you do. You're a dancer. Places like Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, you can stay there for a month in a beautiful art house with a sound system. Not a sound system, a recording studio, by the way.
Wow.
Just saying. I know, for a month just to create Chaco Canyon. I'm just kind of just, you know, saying.
I'm sold.
I know. There's Dry Tortugas not far from you, right? Dry Tortugas.
Yeah.
A national park, Loggerhead Key. You have to take another person with you because you are off the grid for an entire month. What would you do? No Instagramming. You know?
I would live off the fat of the land.
You'd have a good time.
That's a fantasy
there,
of mine.
Well, there you go. Gilligan's Island. It could be Kersner's Island. There it is. Oh, the squid. We got to talk about squids. That would be perfect. Awesome. Squid's Island. Well, thanks again so much. Everyone, keep up with us at bigblendradio.com. You take care, and we'll keep listening.
Thank you, Lisa. Take care.